is Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by Craig Mauger, Simon Schuster, Jacob Kanzler. A little later, the Deputy Director of the Michigan League of Conservation Voters, Jack Schmidt, will be joining us to talk about the energy policy. But first, guys, why does it seem like Governor Snyder is kind of softening a little bit on the Syrian refugee situation? Is it just me, or is he kind of getting a little squishy on this, Craig?
I mean, something's going on here. We were talking about it at our staff meeting. The original story we were just researching, when this first came out, the Governor Snyder wanted to put some type of pause, some type of stop on Syrian refugees coming into our state after what happened in Paris on Friday a week ago. The original story on the Free Press was headlined, Snyder, colon, no more Syrian refugees in Michigan.
That's pretty strong.
Isn't it? If you just read the headline, not saying that any readers out there across our state would just read the headline of a story and not read the whole thing.
Of course not.
That would never happen. But if you just read that headline, it sounds like basically the governor saying we're not taking any more refugees, period, going forward, ever. But there are still refugees from Syria coming into our state now, and the governor's office is now putting out statements saying we're welcoming these people. So yeah, something happened here.
Right. It's been softened considerably in the press coverage, too, yeah, hasn't it, Simon?
And I think that after the statement came out, Snyder kind of maybe perhaps unexpectedly found himself pulled into a much larger national debate about this issue. And as a result, he's found himself in the same camp with a lot of other governors who have taken much stronger stances, calling for things like religious tests. And so late last week, he did an interview with NPR and Steve Inskeep. He took steps to nuance his position and show that he just wanted a pause. But Steve Inskeep did ask him if he had any specific issues with the review process, and Snyder was not able to name one.
Jake, he has been labeled as leading the stampede of Republican governors asking for a block of Syrian refugees into their state. I don't know if that's necessarily what he wanted to do, is it?
Probably not. I mean, it didn't seem something that governor would do. I mean, I think it's fair to say that he was the first to take this stance when the news broke over the weekend and then everyone followed suit. So the timing of it is interesting. Another thing I would point out that may have led to the message change is the national media did stories again and again saying that governors don't have the power to kind of control who goes into their state. It's a federal thing. They can offer recommendations of whether they want to accept refugees, things like that. But the federal government gets to choose, you know, if we accept refugees and where they go, kind of thing.
Because just over the weekend, Craig, we've had Syrian refugees come into our state. And what can we do about it?
The governor's office issued a really positive statement about it. I think it was in the Free Press that covered that as well.
Yeah, so then the question becomes, then why did Governor Snyder come out as strongly as he did at the beginning in the first place? Was this just a political reaction to something that catastrophic that happened in Paris? And if so, that seems very unlike our political governor, who is not really political at all. So it makes you kind of wonder, was there something else going on here? I'm wondering if there wasn't a little 2018 looking way into the future type of scenario going on here. Obviously, Governor Snyder can't run for re-election, but his lieutenant governor, Brian Kelly, is a conservative voice within that administration. He has been trying to making more moves than he has been in the past toward looking forward in 2018. And the last thing he wants to be seen as is somebody who's not conservative when he does have some conservative credentials, and he doesn't want to be outmaneuvered down the line by someone like Bill Schuette or Candace Miller or anybody else who might want to run. Is that possible? Is that a feasible scenario? Anybody want to jump on that?
I think it's possible, but it makes you wonder why wasn't Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly kind of the face of putting this message out there?
If the
hypothesis that you're forwarding is in fact true, why wasn't Kelly quoted in any of these stories forwarding this stance?
They could have been out together, I suppose. I mean, because the governor is the head of the administration, right? So
yeah, you know, that doesn't stop the lieutenant governor from kind of leading, you know, a press release or announcement on other issues that he's on, like special education or autism. I mean, it wouldn't be unprecedented for him to be leading some kind of charge on that kind of thing. I don't know.
I'm just throwing it out there because it seems unlike our governor to lead the charge on something like this when he's been trying to lead the charge in bringing immigrants and political refugees into our state.
My theory is that, this is my theory, and I don't have information on this, but if I had to guess, which is probably, this is a bit haphazard, but I would think that maybe what happened is the Governor Snyder has been outspoken on being welcoming to even to Syrian refugees, to any type of refugee. He's been outspoken on that previously. So when this happened, someone asked him, what do you think now that this attack happened? in Paris. What do you think? He gave an answer, and maybe the answer was interpreted in a way that he didn't intend it, and the headline was, "No more Syrian refugees in Michigan," initially. And then the next day, it was changed to a pause. It wasn't changed, but the story was kind of updated to a pause on refugees coming to Michigan. So that was softened. And since, it's been further softened. So it makes you think maybe something happened on the communication side of this.
Yeah, and I mean, if we're going to speculate here, you know, he is someone who's obviously come out very strongly for the Syrian program. And I think that he quickly found himself, when he issued the statement, within bedfellows that he might have found somewhat unsavory in regards to their positions. He's probably taken one of the more measured stances in terms of governors that have raised concerns. And in that regard, the fact that he's, you know, been positioned perhaps unwittingly as the leader of this movement, it's probably quite unsavory to him.
So he doesn't want to be on the same page as Donald Trump, who is talking about creating lists and things like that.
Precisely.
I can't see Governor Snyder being supportive of some kind of Arab-American list. I would agree with you on that. All right, speaking about politics, now that we kind of transitioned into politics, Craig, you spent all day Friday taking a look at House races. Not really too early to start thinking about this. We're less than a year away, and the maneuvering is well underway on both the Republican and Democratic side. Just from reading your story and from talking around, it does seem like the Democrats kind of have a leg up right now in 2016 in the state House.
Well, they've got a map that's really to their advantage. They've got a team of people organizing the campaign that's been intact for a while that gives them an advantage over the Republicans, who are kind of getting their team's legs on the ground. They've just got a lot going for them. They don't really have to play defense in any seat. I mean, that's a huge advantage. And when was the last time that that happened where one side didn't even have to think about playing defense?
We've had 15 House races put on the list, and we picked 15 because it seemed like a good, round, manageable number. And we had to wait until number 15 until you found a seat that could conceivably go from Democrat to Republican, but that's even a stretch because the Republicans don't even have a candidate.
Not yet. And I was and sources that I was working with on the story were debating me whether a Democratic seat should even be on this list. And many of them said, no, you shouldn't have a Democrat seat even in the top 15. And I, from where it stands today, I think this seat isn't the seat we're talking about, is the Gretchen Driscoll seat 52. I put it on the list because there is some uncertainty about who the Republican candidate will be.
What a strange, odd situation that we find themselves in, that there are no seats really that the Republicans can conceivably go in and capture. It's all of a defensive strategy right now, and they're, I think, on their heels because I'm not really seeing a leadership team kind of gelling together. I'm not even seeing, like in 2006 when the Republicans lost control, at least they had Craig DeRoche still kind of leading the charge. He was still the face of the movement. They just kind of got blindsided. In this case, I'm not really seeing a leadership group kind of congeal together. I'm sensing a vacuum, personally.
Yeah, there's a lot of uncertainty, I think, about for the House Republicans about, at the end of the day, who's going to be calling all of these shots. Is it going to be Speaker Cotter, or is it going to be Tom Leonard, who some people think is the next speaker, and he's the House Republican campaign chair? And then there are other kind of dissident members of the caucus who want to go a different direction. So there is a vacuum there, and it will be interesting to see how that vacuum impacts the decision-making that happens. I know there's a feeling among some House Republicans that the former campaign chair, Eric Nesbitt, needs to get more involved. They'd like to see him get more involved because he did so well in 14.
You talked about Tom Leonard. There's also Rob Verheulen out there, isn't he working with Laura Cox? Is that
Rob Verheulen is someone that a lot more people are talking about as a potential next speaker or House Republican leadership candidate. He's not a guy who loves to like dive into politics and talk about politics, but he's playing his cards close to the vest, kind of maybe in a Paul Ryan type of fashion, where if people want me to do it and everyone says we want Verheulen to be our leader, that he would do it.
Because he's kind of that stabilizing presence, isn't he? I mean, he's somebody who's well-grounded and comes from a place of respect. And I think he could be someone people come to say, all right, we need a leader. We feel like you're the person who can do it. The fundraising's not coming together right now for the Republicans. They had a god-awful last quarter, almost historically bad. You know, they're going to have to come back with some more money if they're going to try and convince kind of the standard people around town here that they've got the mojo to beat back some of the Democrats here. Because you take a look at this map, Craig, you could argue there's a couple of seats right now that are already off the board for the Republicans.
There are a couple of seats where they're in a dire situation.
Yeah, you would put that. You would put dire situation. I would say the 23rd district there downriver that Pat Summerville amazingly captured back in 2010. You can almost just take that almost right off the board. He won that in a wave election and just worked his fanny off and just kept working it, and that's how they won that seat in the first place. He beat an incumbent who was horrible, who had her own real serious problems, never worked. Okay, I mean, that was just an amazing situation. And I would say, too, I mean, you can't discount in a lot of these elections what the national atmosphere is like. You know, the caucuses can do so much, but at the end of the day, it seems like the national atmosphere is what swings this thing. Keep going back to the Muskegon district, the Holly Hughes district. You know, I don't know how much her vote on the gas tax increase and the registration fee increase really impacts her, because I think back when Valentine held the seat, Mary Valentine, mm-hmm. she upset Farhat, and you know, it swings back to the Republican. Then Valentine, you know, leaves, and Hughes comes in, and then Colleen Lamonte, and all of these are like what is happening outside of the race itself. What are the national politics like? How well is Hillary Clinton going to do? And I think that may play just as big of a factor as kind of the other things we're talking about.
Yeah, and I mean, when you look at these parties on a national scale, that's really what's going to influence voter turnout and mobilization during this election in 2016. I think what you're seeing now among the candidates on a national stage is a convergence of opinion on some issues, but when you look at candidates like Trump and Ben Carson, you're also seeing a solidification of some of the fractures. And in a party that's plagued by infighting and their inability to have a unified platform, even, you know, a year from the election, I think that's all those things are going to be working in the Democrats' favor.
That's an interesting point there. What happens if Donald Trump's the nominee? How does that impact the House races? Because obviously he's a polarizing figure, and will that depress Republican turnout? I mean, that's a possibility, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas on the Democratic side, we pretty much know what's going to happen there, right? I mean, Bernie Sanders is going to hang around for a while, and there's some other options out there for Democrats if something catastrophic happens to Hillary Clinton, but she's going to be the nominee, and she's got a lot of support. She's encouraging, she's kind of motivating Democrats right now and getting them excited, and the Republicans don't have that right now.
I think the national environment is important, but sometimes it can be overrated. I think if Democrats want to get to 9 to flip the House, they do need a really good national environment. They need Hillary to win Michigan kind of walking away. They need that to get to 9. But I think some of these seats, like the Holly Hughes seat, 91, the Teresa Abed 71 seat, the Bison seat, some of these seats are going to be close regardless of what the national environment is. And I think just because it is a presidential year, there are going to be more Democrats probably coming to the polls that are going to help the Democrats there. So, I mean, it's still, I think to get to 9, they do need Hillary to do pretty well.
Well, we're going to keep our eyes on those races and others, but let's get on to the interview portion of our podcast. Jack Schmidt, Deputy Director of the League of Conservation Voters. Thanks for joining us on the program today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, the big thing that the House and the Senate are going to be taking up when we return from the Thanksgiving break is this energy debate. What are the two top things you guys would like to see? If you could make your own legislation, mm-hmm. what are the two top things you would like to see in this energy bill?
Yep, there are two pieces that are critical to us that we've been talking about since this discussion really began. The first is building upon the success that our current renewable portfolio standard has demonstrated. So we've got that 10% by 2015 goal right now. We'd like to see that expanded. And then the second piece is looking at energy waste reduction. We've got a 1% a goal year right now for reducing energy waste. We'd like to see that increased.
Okay, so let's start with the renewable portfolio standards. 10% by 2015, what would you like to see that go to ideally?
You know, you could say 1.5% per year, which is about the rate at which we've added renewable capacity since PA 295 went into place. So we'd like to see that 1.5% a year increased. Essentially, wherever you want to end that date, it results in a different calculation. So that could be 30% by 2030. It could be a number of different things. So we're flexible on that end date, but really it's that 1.5% a year continuation we'd like to see.
Does it have to come from Michigan?
You know, I think we've part of the success of our renewable portfolio standard is the renewable industry that it's driven here in Michigan. And to that end, I think it is productive for it to be coming from the state.
But it doesn't have to, right? I mean, if it was imported wind from Iowa, does that make a difference to you guys in the end?
I think we'd prefer to see that 50-50 split that we've got right now. So there's at least a requirement that some of it is coming from Michigan. Yeah.
Reducing energy waste.
Yeah. Isn't that just code for energy efficiency? Is this the new verbiage for energy efficiency?
Well, I think we've heard Governor Snyder talk about the need to reduce energy waste. I think certainly whether you call it a code word for energy efficiency or really just a framing of the issue that speaks more directly to folks about what it is. I mean, we're maybe trying to get away from folks. Remember the big pushes in the 70s for energy efficiency and putting in light bulbs. And sometimes there's a perception that we've already done everything we can to be more efficient simply by putting in compact fluorescent light bulbs. And the reality is much further we could go. And so that's why, reducing energy waste, energy efficiency, you're right, they're pretty much synonymous terms, but we choose to go with that reducing energy waste.
Now, reducing energy waste, does that just basically mean creating programs to outfit outdated homes, help the poor people get better appliances in their buildings, shore up the insulation, that kind of stuff?
It's both about residential customers. It's also about businesses, helping businesses become more energy efficient. So it's broader than just certainly a big chunk of their programs that help put more energy efficiency, energy efficient appliances in place, help folks, like you said, put insulation in, but it's also helping businesses do some more, take some more steps.
How genuine do you think DT and consumers are in trying to advance these energy waste reduction type programs?
They've certainly talked at length about the benefits that these provide to their customers. And so I think they are able to claim a benefit to their customers here. I mean, you see advertisements that they release that talk about how they can help folks, help you get a more efficient dryer. But there's no question that, what we've seen in the legislature is not necessarily, they're not advocating for that increase. You can read into that what you'd like, but I do think that there are benefits for the utilities in this, and certainly they do communicate with their customers about, the benefit that they can provide.
So the House passed a plan just a couple weeks ago in their committee. It's now on the House floor. Senator Mike Knopf has something in his committee. Which one of these two bills would you rather see go forward, the Knopf's bill or the House bill?
I think it's really early in the process. And so essentially either package could be used as a vehicle for the policy that we'd like to see. I wouldn't want to kind of position us in one corner or the next that one is necessarily better than the other. Either package could be used as a vehicle for the direction we'd like to go. As it currently stands today, the legislation, the language that we're currently looking at, I do think that what came out of Nesbitt's committee is a little bit of an improvement. We said when that came out of committee that it is a step in the right direction. It's not nearly far enough, but it did push a conversation about advancing renewable energy in the state, about continuing our energy efficiency programs. And so to that end, we do think that that package, as it came out of committee, is a step in the right direction.
Basically, right now, as it stands in the House, you have some Republicans who are really against these changes to choice that are going to be made. That gives Democrats some leverage to change these bills to kind of their favor, maybe some of the things that you'd like to see. How should Dems handle that? I mean, to not go too far where they lose their leverage, but to get the things that they want. I mean, how would you advise them on that?
The key thing for them is they issued a platform at the beginning of this discussion really early on. I think that was February, right? Mm-hmm. Really early on in this discussion. They articulated their vision for energy policy. And if I'm in their shoes, I want to stick to my guns on that platform that as a caucus they released and supported. And many of them signed on to bills and introduced them to that effect. I think that there's maybe some concerns that in previous discussions over the past few weeks they've overplayed their hand and it hasn't worked out right. I think here we're seeing an example of the fact that they really are, if they stick to their platform, in a position to lead on energy policy and carve out something that's pretty close to what they articulated.
Who do you think is driving the train on this energy policy? Is it fair to say this is DTE and consumers who are steering this discussion right now?
I think there's certainly a big player in the discussion. Where we also see one of the primary issues that's being discussed is really how the market is regulated. And I think that that's largely driven by the utilities. Yeah.
So if these guys weren't pushing for changes in this 2008 law, do you think we'd be having this discussion right now?
We came to the legislature a couple years ago and said, a major priority is updating our renewable energy standard. It ends this year. That goal was set in 2015. So I'd like to think that we'd be driving that discussion even if the utilities weren't also.
Going back to the renewable energy standard part, one thing I want to know is, does the state need a goal set in law to kind of get to where we need to go on renewables, in your opinion?
It does. We set performance standards for our utilities in a number of different areas, whether that's determining rates for utility customers, whether that's setting goals for how much renewable energy they should generate. And I think, you know, we've seen that if we're not putting that assurance in state law, we can't always guarantee that those standards are going to be met. So to that end, we do believe that it's necessary to put a standard in place.
So a goal's not good enough.
We've got some serious questions about what that language actually means and whether it's enforceable.
Because we had goals put in that House language, and it's not enforceable, but it's better than nothing, right?
That's why we said it's a step in the right direction, but not nearly far enough. You're right. I mean, it's advancing a discussion about the need for more renewable energy, which I won't criticize. I think that that's a positive development. But there are some legitimate questions that are out there that, you know, we're working to try and get an answer to, frankly, as to whether or not that goal language is enforceable, whether or not it's something that the utilities actually end up living up to.
In the Senate, there is a big debate about net metering, mm-hmm. about using energy that you produce either through solar panels on your roof or if you have a little windmill or something like that, and how much you can sell that back to the utility. Where is the League of Conservation Voters on that issue?
We're very supportive of net metering policies and think, you know, strongly opposed to the provisions in that Senate package that would walk us backwards on kind of our current net metering program. We're an organization that represents people on both sides of the aisle. We've got folks on our board of directors from both sides of the aisle. This is an issue that's got broad appeal to Republicans, to Democrats, really to all of us as Michiganders, the idea of if you're investing in putting renewable energy infrastructure on your property, on your house, on your home, on your business, you should have the ability to sell that back at a fair rate to the utilities if you're generating more electricity than you're using.
So the current policy is okay, really?
Current policy is okay, yeah.
Just kind of switch gears here a little bit to politics. Yeah. How involved is the League of Conservation Voters when it comes to House elections? How active do you see your group being in 2016?
Pretty consistently for at least the past two cycles in 2012 and 2014, Michigan League of Conservation Voters and our affiliated political action committees have been heavily involved in state House elections. We've spent upwards of $200,000, $250,000 in each of the last two cycles. And, you know, going into 2016, we don't have a statewide race. We don't have a state Senate up. So certainly a state House is going to receive a lot of attention from us.
And what are the criteria that you use? Is it just Democrats you endorse, or?
Nope, we endorse on both sides of the aisle. You know, folks may remember we endorsed Governor Snyder in the 2010 Republican gubernatorial primary. We've endorsed folks like Rob Verheulen and a number of others in the state House. We will continue to do so again in 2016. Wayne Schmidt in his state Senate race is another one. So we endorse on both sides of the aisle and got a number, but essentially boil down to, are they proficient on the issues? If they're currently elected to office, how they've performed while they've been in office, and are they a viable candidate?
What are the biggest issues you guys are going to be talking to potential candidates about for 16?
I think energy policy is certainly one of them.
Even if that could be done.
Yeah, even if that's completed. I mean, I think that, you know, as we've seen in this legislature with term limits, a new crop of legislators could come in. And just because we did energy policy this cycle doesn't mean that some new folks don't come in next and want to either undo what we've done. So I think that energy policy is certainly something we'll be talking about. The other, I think, are water issues and looking at, you know, we've seen a toxic algae bloom in Western Lake Erie. We've seen algae blooms in Saginaw Bay and Lake Makatawa. So inland lakes are Great Lakes. This is really the next huge critical issue that we as a state and Great Lakes region are going to face when it comes to environmental concerns. And so that's another one that we'll be talking to candidates about.
All right, Jack Schmidt from the League of Conservation Voters. Thanks for joining us on the podcast today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And that's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Thanks to Jack Schmidt for coming in today, and Craig and Simon and Jacob. I've got a little Tom Petty today with the refugee. We're kind of mixing things up here with the music, I think. I think it's a good change, yes? No?
Are you living out your desire to be a DJ? You have DJed a wedding, right?
Yeah, I did DJ a wedding, now that you mention it. How did you know that? Did I tell you that before?
I think I've heard about it a few times.
Oh, okay. Well, and I also, I did, as a matter of fact. And I also DJed, when I was a high schooler, my friend and I DJed the school dances, too.
Oh, did you really?
Yeah,
what kind of things were you playing there?
Well, it was a lot of Vanilla Ice, Ice Baby. I remember we played that a couple times in one dance due to popular request. We could have probably played that song over and over again.
That would have been a fitting song for today's podcast as well.
Oh, yeah, that is.
42 degrees in our office.
Can we get Ice Baby in here? We get Cold of Ice. Cold as Ice from Foreigner. I like that one too.
I like where you're going here.
All right. All I know is that it's warmed up in here. It used to be 42 degrees when Lori walked in this morning. I think it's now approaching sauna temperatures.
I'm going to be able to ruin my coat soon. Remove my coat.
Well, yeah. Craig's already taken his coat off. Simon has too. Get comfortable here.
I'll get there.
All right. Well, no, it's warm when I have to take off this pullover and I'm on t-shirt mode. I don't think we're that far away now. Not that anyone really gives a rip.
Yeah, I'm going to ask this to come up the final edit.
Yes, I hope so.
So you're wearing a t-shirt on Monday. Our listeners should know that. We're just kind of
Yeah, please, nobody call a press conference that I actually got to go to, or else I'm going to have to go home and dress up, please. Okay, we got a phone call. That means we got to go. Until next week, I'm Kyle Mlynn. Take care.